I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thank you. Can you hear us? Or can you hear me, anyway, to start with? Paul and I have just been discussing when we first met, and we know it was in the 1980s, but we're not prepared to commit to a date.
Not yet.
The reason we met was because in the 1980s, the piazza in Covent Garden, we were still all quite excited that it hadn't actually been demolished. And it was still a place where there were small shops and slightly interesting ventures going on. And I used to spend a lot of my time when I was supposed to be at work wandering around there. And in the lower level of the piazza, there was this place called Cabaret Mechanical Theatre, and it was very brightly painted, kind of end of the pier, very jolly, except that outside it, there was this huge life-size mechanical skeleton, which was a bit odd. And it was sort of two-thirds of a skeleton in a glass box, Perspex box, and if you put 50p in, something would happen. So I put them 50p in, and it was called The Last Judgment. And in the ribs, the souls in purgatory revolved. In the skull, the righteous, who looked incredibly boring and smug, sat in their pews applauding. And in the basement, the devils, who were having some time off from the routine of tormenting, had a cafe, and they were playing pool and, you know, generally relaxing. So obviously the next thing to do is to go into Cabaret. And we'll talk more about Cabaret later. But in there were a number of pieces by the same mind that had produced The Last Judgment. And they varied in their kind of effect, and themes emerged. This was obviously done by someone who had a deep desire to puncture the self-satisfaction of cats. Various things nasty happened to cats. Some things depended on their title. There was a very charming, almost like a child's toy scene of sailors sitting around apparently a roast turkey, and when you press the button, because your buttons were free once you'd paid to get in, and they all banged their knives and forks, but it was called The Last Dodo. So it was kind of unpleasant. And then there were a lot of things that featured Anubis, the Egyptian god of the dead. So I decided I must find out who was behind all this. And in those days, I worked for Country Life magazine. So I went down to see Paul, and I'm not sure who was more surprised, Paul or the editor of Country Life, that we suddenly had this four-page feature on moving models of Anubis, in one case drawing a sausage. So I thought I'd start this conversation with you, Paul, because you know all this. Why Anubis?
Well, he seemed like a good idea at the time, I think. Mm-hmm. No. Well, and also making effigies of animals is easier than making effigies of people. People have to have expressions on their faces, and dogs usually look pretty dumb to me most of the time. I mean, to their owners, they probably seem to be fascinating and interesting things. But I think that putting an animal head on a human body is an interesting thing to do. And I wanted to liberate Anubis from this Egyptian thing of being that way, then that way, then that way. So that was one thing. But it was sort of... I mean, I worried about this because Crafts magazine sent Dayan Sujic, Down, who's later gone on to bigger things, who wrote an article for Crafts magazine about me, and he said I was whimsical. And it's always rankled. Because, I mean, you can be I can be whimsical choosing to do Anubis once, but 40 or 50 times.
Yeah, that, yeah, it's not accidental.
You know, there's method there, isn't there? Some kind of.
Yeah.
Angle.
Though I remember you got quite cross because I said there was a slight air of obsession about some of your work, and you have reminded me that of that obsessively for the last 30
Stop
years.
Stop it. Yeah.
No, it's not obsessive. No, I agree. It's not
right.
obsessive, and it's not whimsical.
No, don't start a fight now because. Really.
Good time to go. Would you mind just sort of taking us back to the beginning? Because your first thing was this Anubis drawing a sausage thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was a perfect... Well, I like to have justifications for things, even if I've only thought of them after I've made the thing. So the sausage, Anubis, Lord of the Mummy wrappings, in charge of preservation of bodies or, you know, sending flesh on to the other world. And a sausage is a perfect representative, preservation of flesh. And that all seemed to fit quite nicely to me. And I would write on the ends of these things, the sides, this justification. So didn't seem unreasonable that Anubis should, if he materialised in modern times, would be interested
in sausages.
Stuffed with preservatives, aren't they? Absolutely rammed with preservatives, unless you get, artisan sausage.
Yes.
Which are.
Right, okay. Well, I can tell we're not going to get any other
Anubis. Well, there's nothing sort of metaphysical. When I mention Anubis, I always capitalise his name, so it's his with a capital H.
Yes.
So there is something slightly kind of... I could possibly be recruited as a priest of Anubis if called upon. But nobody's been knocking on my door.
That's good. We'd be worrying if they had. But I think the other thing that maybe goes with Dejan suggesting you were whimsical is.
He wasn't suggesting, he was telling me.
That's pretty exciting. But the idea of whimsy comes from the fact that people expect anything that moves to be either a bit like a toy or to be like those amazing 18th century mechanical figures, which are incredibly skillful, but they're all craft. And I remember one of the things you explained to me when I came down to see you was that was called smooth autometry, and you did not belong to the smooth school, you belonged to the school of rough autometry.
Yeah. Well, it sort of lets you off having to make things perfectly. I mean, I'm not saying that I don't admire those things, but I think they've fitted into the late 18th century very nicely, and they were sort of philosophically out at the time.
But there are still people who make very exquisite...
I know, but they're the people who make watches, you know. I think the Jacques Edros factory... who have the name that I think is Badge Engineering, then they made watches, these enormous watches that rich people wear. But if you run out of arm, then you might need something else, and they've started making automata again of that sort, of that they write and they play musical instruments and things. But I think they're more or less mechanical corpses. I don't think there's...
Yes.
That much fun. They're not fun.
Absolutely. No, I mean, the rough thing is, because it wasn't just you. I mean, there was, in Cabaret, there was Peter Markey, there was Tim Hunkin. And you, what about that sort of school, that group?
Because we're ideas, driven by ideas, I think, and jokes. And Hunkin's always said that he makes mechanical cartoons. And I've always said it too. I mean, that's what it is. You're trying to make it. I mean, the ironic thing is that you think of a joke that takes you a moment, and then you spend a week or 2 weeks or a month making it into a thing that people can comprehend. And that begins to get a little bit smooth, really. That begins to get a little bit
intense. Do you have
intense,
to kind of hold yourself back from veering towards smoothness?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. Me particularly. I'm the worst of them, really. I'm the nearest to a smooth automatist in this sort of group community of automata. I don't even like being called an automatist. In fact, I'm liking it less and less.
So what are you then?
I'm an alternative artist now, I think.
Oh, you are, yeah. Are you? Because for a long time, we've got down here, on our list of things that we thought we would talk about, it says, I've put, is it art, in quotes, and you've said, in brackets, shouldn't take long.
No.
But I'm going to make you take a little moment about this, because the whole thing about moving sculpture, which was fine in the Middle Ages, and I mean, Leonardo made sculptures that moved, and it was taken all very seriously. Yeah. And then at some point you get this beginning of a long decline into it just being toys and silly. And then, I mean, when does it begin? Is it Alexander Calder? I mean, noticed? Because you made moving sculptures at art school.
I did, yeah.
You did?
Yeah, yeah. Do you know, I'm not sure.
Did you like Calder?
Yes, yeah. But I think I probably liked Calder after I'd started. I think I sort of... I mean, there are machines in my family, really, so I think that making things was an objective.
So how do machines, as it were, run in your family?
My dad was an engineer. He was in the Royal Engineers. He was one of these people who couldn't understand how people didn't get 100% in maths exams. You know, it's obvious, you know. What?
Did you get 100% in maths?
I just wrote my name on the O-level paper. No, it's just useless. I can't even count my change in a pub. I'm just hopeless at all that. No, so, you know, my dad and I, we sort of parted company in that area. But it was just a sense. He was always sort of taking machinery to pieces, and he was a motorbike man and a bicycle man. I think a lot of these people start with bicycles, and they've got a bike and they take it to bits, and then they put all the bits together. And then he was motorbikes, and for a lot of my childhood, he was making motor cars. So he'd get several motor cars that didn't work and put them together, and one of them sort of would. And he was always sort of sucking petrol through tubes to make them work, you know. In my family, I think there seemed to be always problems. There were mechanical all problems were mechanical, and all solutions were mechanical. So, you know, there was little time for any sort of subtleties or poetry, any of that sort of nonsense. So, I think I did grow up with that idea that machines
but
were the things that mattered.
But then you went to art school.
Then I went to art school. Yeah.
So how did that go down with your dad?
He was mystified. He's dead, but he spent the last years of his life being mystified about me. But he carried on making machines. He retired to Cyprus and had a shed. We all have sheds. He spent all his time making machines. He'd make a machine tool that would make another machine tool, and that in turn would make another one. So he'd do things like spending weeks making a hacksawing machine, which would then be used to saw up metal to make a lathe or a milling machine or a bandsaw or something. But actually the time he spent sawing the thing out, to make the hacksaw, he could easily have hacksawed it by hand.
And, yes, but that would have been quite wrong. Well, I mean, that's another interesting thing that I remember from when I very first talked to you, the idea that the mechanism is the driver of the idea as well as the driver of the machine. I remember you saying to me, because I was a bit puzzled by this, and you said, if you've got a wheel and you put pins in it off-centre, I can't remember the correct word, and you said, if you then turn that, then it's like a model going down a catwalk.
Yeah. Well, you lift it.
Yes, I mean, I can see it now you say it, but the number of people who would put asymmetric pins in a wheel and then think, I'll make that into a... So what I'm interested in is the way that the mechanical idea comes first, sometimes.
It's ideally the two things just...
Come together.
Fit together, yeah. The idea and the mechanism. Because usually the things I make... have a top and a bottom. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to pass this round, actually, so you can play with it. But, I mean, this is a sort of... What does it do? There's a lever. It's kind of... It's a little bit like what you were describing there, because that goes... There's that thing that goes up and down. This is called The Invisible Man and the Invisible Woman on Their Honeymoon. So I'm going to let you play with that and pass it round. And if I hear it going every now and then, it will make me think somebody's lost interest in this talk. Well, it just seems, it sort of seems natural to me, really, Rosemary.
Yes, that's it's a way of thinking. But you do also draw. You draw a lot.
Yeah.
So where, at what point, I'm sure it's not the same every time, but where do the mechanisms, the drawings, and then the building of the actual thing, do they all go on at the same time? Do you go back and draw at a certain point, or once you've drawn it, do you then go ahead and do
it? It's ambitious conjecture. Mm. It's wordless ambitious conjecture. Which is something that Dylan Thomas said about his poem. Somebody asked him whether he'd written a particular poem because they were waiting for it.
Yes.
And he said, he made notes about half of it. He thought of the rest. And the rest was radiantly unworded in ambitious conjecture. And I think that sort of went bong in my head when I read that recently, because... You can describe. I mean, I could describe something like this. If I described this thing to you, it'd take about 20 minutes, and you still wouldn't get it. But if I showed it to you,
yes, yes,
right.
Yeah.
See, it works.
Yeah, it does.
Doesn't it? But
I'm
absolutely stumped as to how to describe that to you.
But this, yes, but you do a lot of drawings, but they never look like the
thing. Well, I do the drawings, and I can understand that from drawing it, that particular thing. But that tells me all sorts of things. That I've made things with four faces.
Yes.
So you've seen that, the policeman, the good cop, bad cop.
Yes.
Where a face rotates very suddenly, whips around like that, and you've got a new face. He's got two ears, which are also noses.
Yes.
And he's got four eyes and four mouths. Hooray! Thank you, Gary. But, I mean, I sort of speak the language of those things. So, and the drawings, I can, to an extent, draw and then imagine the machinery itself.
But you do use... Language as well, as I say,
speechy language.
Because I mean, the titles, the Last Dodo is not terribly sinister until you read the title.
No, well, I have been known to make an edition of something, and then title them all differently. So, that's one of the things, that's one of the joys of making these things. In fact, one of the things that relieves the tedium of making more than one. Is that you can call them different things. So there's little ones with Anubis riding a camel.
Yes.
I think I made about 20 or 30 of those, and I thought I'll give them all the different little label on the back. They have label. That one, bonging one, has a little label on it. And that's part of the fun of doing it. Is
well, it's also, you have said that part of the pleasure of doing an edition, and even more if you retitle it, is as a kind of antidote to the collector mentality. Because it kind of drives them mad, because there isn't...
They need the set. Yeah, collect the set. Yeah. Well,
yes.
I'm much amused by collectors, and very grateful to collectors. But it is an odd thing. But it's a true thing of people that you've got one, right? So you've got one. I mean, you can live with that.
Yeah.
But then you get another that fits into the same category, and then you're on the sort of slippery slope to wanting a third. And there are people, thank goodness, who want a lot. And they're, you know, it's one of those things that you do. I mean, I've got collections of... I collect things just for silly reasons. I've got... collection of flat frogs that you might have seen. Frogs that have been run over.
Yes.
And I nail them on the beams of my shed.
Yes.
They're all rotting now. Sort of
they
dropping
would, yes.
Coverings of
no, I haven't been in your shed for a while.
No, I wouldn't. Don't recommend it. No.
And there's the other kind of collecting, which is the collecting box, because, I mean, how do you actually make a career as a not an automatist? One way is to find the collectors who will buy the finished objects, yeah. And the other way, which is one of the things I loved about cabaret, the whole enterprise of cabaret, was that everybody for, is it 50p or 10p?
20, yeah, okay. 20, the skeleton was 20, not
was
50,
really
excuse
obviously.
Me.
That's, you know, the inflation,
I don't want to be
memory,
greedy.
Isn't it? But everybody, it was when you put the money in, it was your work of art,
yeah.
for the long,
yeah.
as long as it lasted,
yeah.
for 20p.
Yeah.
And it was, that was absolutely great. And you've done a lot of collecting boxes for, one of which I half voiced, for museums. Mm. And would you like to tell people about the one for Greenpeace that didn't work?
Yeah, well, it would be cowardly of me not to respond to that.
But
it didn't work very well at all. it was a little scene on top of the box, and there was, I think there were four seals on it, and there were four little men in high-vis jackets whacking it with clubs, and it just went all the time, and you had to pay it to stop. And one day it just stopped and never started again, as far as I remember. There, yeah, yes. So
yeah.
I think that covers that.
I think that covers that. And you've said that the whole process of making, and I think a lot of people in a lot of different fields will identify with this, is a process of kind of steady or unsteady disillusionment from the moment when you think, "Hey,
yeah.
I've got a great idea."
Yeah. Yeah.
You still think that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Well. The main pleasure in making these things for me is the process of making them. It's a bit like if you're in business and you have the first briefing and you all go to the pub and, you know, it's all very inchoate, it's all sort of up in the air. And you imagine, you know, that everything's going to be great. Then you can do drawings and that's okay. Then you start making bits of it, and it sort of goes all right for a while. And usually with machines, you put one part of the mechanism in place, and then you have to put the next one in, and it gets in the way. The first one gets in the way of the second one, and then the second one gets in the way of the third one. And you think, oh, Christ, I've got to sort of drill all those holes again or throw that box away. And it does become tedious. It turns a pleasure into a sort of tedium. And sometimes it's fun almost all the way through. Nearly always when it's finished, I'm sick to death of the thing. And I'd rather I hadn't started. I think, oh, I'll do something, you know, get a proper job or something.
No.
Well, no, people who've been self-employed for, I think, is it 3 years, are unemployable anyway.
I'm hoping so, yeah.
You know, 40 years.
Yes. You're not going to get a job.
It's all over.
But one of the sequence, well, it's not a sequence, one of the groups of works that you made that I thought were incredibly, particularly interesting were the butcher's shops. And I wondered if you wanted to talk about those, because that's another... well, maybe it sort of all dates from Anubis and the Sausage, but they're based on Victorian toy butcher shops, which were very popular, with the very beautifully painted hams and things.
I'm going to correct you there, Rosemary.
Oh, okay.
They weren't toys. Well, the Museum of Childhood says they weren't toys.
Oh, right, okay.
They were put in the windows of butcher shop. Butchers
oh, right.
would buy them, put them in the window... weekends or whenever they weren't
yes.
there, right? And they were very, very beautiful things. I was just entranced by them. And one of the most attractive things was the way you could make little models of legs of lamb and sides of beef and things. And I was attracted by that. But I was also attracted by another aspect of them, which was you'd have the shop there, and then above the shop were little windows with net curtains over them, and nothing inside. But I volunteered to show what was inside, and it was usually something pleasant happening, something lovely. They're enjoying the fruits of the butchery that went on downstairs. The butcher was quite a brutal-looking bloke, usually. of meeting eyebrows, and kind of, a Brexiteer kind of person. But upstairs, something lovely was happening, and one of the ones I liked doing most was one where there's a butcher, I think, the one with the wolves. Yeah, I think it was the second one I made. Is he the one that pushes his way through? Yeah, but the butcher, there's all these dangling... Sorry, that's my memory stick there. No, it's all right. I paid her, it's okay. There are all these hanging carcasses, and he sort of swims through the carcasses, and they all push to one side. And it's sort of beautiful but horrible, because he's a nasty-looking bloke. And then it opens up, and inside there's a forest, and there's a pregnant woman lying in the middle. Lights go on. Light goes on to her tummy, which is pulsing expectantly. And then surrounding her, there are a lot of wolves. And a lot of people take that as pretty threatening and unpleasant. But actually what they're doing is they're apprentice midwife wolves, and they're just waiting for her to give birth and to assist and to be nice. Have I said it properly?
Yeah. You have. Yes. I mean, it's certainly true in a lot of your pieces. The thing that looks happy and innocent turns out not to be, and vice versa.
Probably
and
vice
quite
versa.
Like playing on expectations, and also that I can't remember who it was, the writer from whom you picked up that phrase. Most people will tolerate a certain amount of meaninglessness in their lives.
Yeah. She was a woman called Caroline M. Bloomer. I don't know how I remembered that. I've not mentioned her name for about 20 years. No, 2004 that was. So however many years it is back from, 14 years or something, Caroline M. Bloomer wrote a book.
But the idea of meaninglessness and repetition and...
most people can tolerate a certain...
Most people can...
All the time,
but
sure.
But then your pieces are built on the idea of repetition.
Yeah, I know. Well, I have no choice in that.
Well, you do. You don't have to do...
I could stop, yes.
You could stop. But I mean, they're based on the idea that they have to, physically, literally, they have to repeat.
Yeah.
But then they're also based on subverting that idea, so you don't get bored looking at them.
Well, that's up to... I get bored looking at them, I'm sorry. Yeah, no. No, they're meant to be fun. It's a problem with those things. But then, the Venus of Urbino doesn't move at all.
No, exactly. So, and indeed, having said that Anubis is easier to do than people, I mean, one of the most startling of your early pieces is a recreation of Manet's Olympia, in which the servant coming in with the tray, which has camp coffee on it, is Anubis, who's quivering with overexcitement. Yeah. And Olympia's midriff revolves in the most striking way.
It's a mechanical way as well.
I was going to say, that must have been something you saw as a mechanism and thought that would be very funny if it
that
was a tummy.
Because if you make little puppety things and you can make a little figure with a circular tummy and you wiggle it, as you might just do casually if you're making a little wooden thing, you might sort of wiggle its tummy. And then all the other bits sort of wobble around in sympathy, well, because they're forced, really. It's a thought that has probably occurred to quite a number of people. Having the skills, I was able to take advantage of that. And I don't know why... I'm not sure why Manet's Olympia at first, but I got on with it. I got into it. So I drew. It is funny actually trying to think why you hit on some thing. But actually, no. What you're asking about where does the movement and the idea come together? They do pretty well. Perfectly in that.
They do. So,
yeah.
No, it's a great piece. Yeah. I still don't know why Anubis is bringing her camp coffee.
Well, it's because it's a parody of the original painting.
Yes.
It's got all the same. It's got the woman with no clothes on, and I thought, well, when that painting was done, everybody came and shouted at that painting because she was looking at you, looking at the men in top hats, shamelessly. That was the thing about her. She looked at you like this. Imagine I've got no clothes on. You know what? You know. And then I thought, well, that's not... This is the justification. This is post-making it justification. Was, well, nowadays, you know, there's loads of people with no clothes on staring at you, aren't there? I mean, on the tube and things. Nearly no clothes on, anyway. I know, Rosemary, you live a sheltered life, but, you know. And I thought, well... The justification was that you can add this movement to it, which would make it all the more appalling. Mm. And then in the picture, there's a servant woman who's bringing her flowers wrapped in newspaper, and I sort of transformed that into Anubis, because that's what I did in those days. I don't automatically put Anubis in things anymore, but at the time I did. And as a composition, it helped having him up there. So it's a nice triangular composition. And I concocted a story about a pharaoh whose favourite concubine, I think it was a bit Scheherazade, and his favourite concubine, he wanted to keep her awake for a bit longer because he was busy in the office or something. So he sent his servant Anubis with the camp coffee. Well, I don't know if it does keep you awake or not, but anyway, that was the idea of it.
Right, well, thank you, because I've wondered about that for a long time.
I'm really glad. I'm so glad I can help you out there.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Coming more recently up to date, the sound in your pieces has got more important, and you've been doing a lot with pipe organs.
Yeah.
Say something about that.
If you insist. Yes, well, I've got a pipe here. Well, I've always liked these. I've got a bit of a cuckoo clock here, Jeff. That's either the cook or the oo. And making that bit is really, really easy. I mean, it's just like making a pencil box. I met a man at a party. He was a chemist, I think. And he said, I'm interested in the sort of thing you do. And I've been making an organ for the last 9 years, and I'm halfway there. Because he got these plans.
Right.
And he told me what the plans were, and I sent for them and got them, and it's really easy to do. I mean, you have to make a lot of little pipes. The organs I make have only got 20 pipes in them, and they're
right.
Nice.
It's
makes
a bit
nice
like
noise.
Your dad saying not being able to understand why people couldn't do maths, isn't it? Just make 20 organs.
I mean, it's not hard, And there was an ingenious mechanism this chap had devised that used punched paper.
Pianola?
It's like a pianola, only it's positive pressure. What you do is you put the piece of paper in a box and seal it, and the only outlet is through the pipes. right? So you blow air into the box, and then you run the paper over the thing with the holes in. It's called the keyframe, mm-hmm. technical organ people. And so the air comes from the pressurised box through the keyframe via the hole in the paper. And so each hole in the paper represents a note. You crank it through and blow, and it makes a tune.
And do you want to talk about the piece that you're making at the moment?
That one,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm making
that one. You've already referred kind of obliquely to it.
Yeah, I thought about 3 years ago, I thought I want to make a thing that has 100 people standing on it, and 48 of them will go one way and 52 of them will go the other way. Because I don't see there's a big difference between 48 and 52, frankly. I don't say that one overwhelms the other as a majority. I mean, I'm thinking in very basic terms about these things. But so I made this thing. I thought, I'll make 100 people, and then I'll think what to do with them. And I did. I made 100 people. I made their heads first, and then I made their bodies. And then I thought, oh, Christ. I put them all on the floor. It was bloody huge. It was, it was about 6 feet across if they were all standing. And then I thought, I'd have to make an organ, because I make organs now. But I made it with an electronic MIDI system, which means that instead of paying a man in Melton Mowbray to punch the paper for me, you just get these little memory sticks, poke them in with a tune embedded in it, and it would play hundreds of tunes, literally hundreds of tunes, one little thing. So I made the organ bit. And then I made two sort of carriages, and I put them, 48 of the people on one side, 52 on the other, selected randomly.
Of course.
And I made a mechanism that as the organ plays, the two carriages move. I called it the English Spring. and the two parts, first of all, they're all standing there looking at you, and they all shun each other. They move in a shunning mechanism, and then they all drift apart, and then it stops.
What
I was going to do is
get left in limbo.
Then it sort of goes back. But what I was going to do was have some ghastly thing in the gap in the middle. Some horrible entity would take possession of this space. But what I did, because I ran out of time, is it's in the art gallery in Falmouth at the moment, but they're just about to chuck it out, and I'm going to have it in my shed again, which would mean I can't move. I just put I saw an etching by Ensor about Leopold II, who was particularly nasty. King of Belgians, and went around chopping people's hands off in Congo and things. And I used a quotation from that, which said, what does it say soon? I've forgotten it. It says, what is it you want? What do you want? Aren't you happy? In French. I've got O-level French, just. And it seemed like that's what it said to me.
Yep.
First person to see it was a French woman, and she said, "That's the most atrocious French. Even that is like schoolboy." Well, this is Ensor, who's Belgian, so it is. And I even got the circumflex accent on. I did it all right, but that was a slight come down. And I had a correspondent, Peter Fluck's wife.
Oh, right.
Who's French. And we had a sort of correspondence about it, but she's now agreed that probably Belgians did talk like that in those days. Anyway, but there's more to do. I'm going to make it so it's got two coin slots, one for go and one for stay, and then it will then be... Then there'll be a sort of new referendum. So, and I get the money, you see.
Yeah, it's a win-win.
Yes.
Very good. In a minute or so, I think we should let other people have a go. But I thought, because you also...
I've got to do this.
One more.
Right.
Bookshop,
I'm sorry.
You should maybe
It's like a WI all over again.
Yes. This is Lytton Strachey. Would you like to explain why?
Sarah, you sent me that lovely little book about the Bloomsbury, because this is Bloomsbury, isn't it? Apart from going to the British Museum, I don't know anywhere. But it was a very nice little book about Bloomsbury. And Lytton Strachey is one of the heroes of this book and is becoming a hero of mine, I think. Because one of the things he says is that you can't do intellectual work unless you're completely relaxed. And there's lots of pictures in this book of Lytton in deck chairs, draped in deck chairs. And there's that famous Henry Lamb picture of him. You know. Anyway, I've made this machine called Lytton Strachey Trying to Get Comfortable. It's got a deck chair. And every now and then he kind of lands in the deck chair. But I'm so glad that Jacob Rees-Mogg has made this. He's kind of really... I'm putting this up by a tenner. It's going up. But I think Jacob looks like a sort of one of those people with beards that you see nowadays, version. A hipster version of Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Hard to imagine.
I wouldn't bother if I were. No, but
are people allowed to turn that round?
Yeah, you can. Yeah,
because they might like to do that while
you can have it. Yeah, you probably can't break it. He's trying to get comfortable, Jenny. He's not succeeding.
No. Would anyone like to ask us, mainly Paul, any questions?
Living as I do not far from Melton Mowbray, I'm concerned that a man's been punching paper and his punched paper hasn't been used to produce music. Could you just explain? So you built an organ, but it runs off an MP3 player.
I've made three. One works with the punched paper that Melvin Wright, the man in Melton Mowbray, is called. And he's a very efficient puncher-outer of paper. So you can send him... Can't you, Matthew? You can send him a MIDI file, and then 2 days later, you get a mile of paper back with the tune punched into it. But I made two that work that way. There's one called Les Demoiselles, I called it, and it's an organ that works with punched paper, but it has a continuous roll in it, which causes lots of technical problems actually. But it means you don't have to wind it back again. But it's got Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon on it. It's got Manet's Olympia quite big on it. It's got the Virgin Mary feeding the baby Jesus pneumatically from one pulsing breast. And it has two harpies flying around it. It's got a model of Peter Markey. No, it's got a grey figure cranking one of Peter Markey's dancing ladies things on it. Sounds good, doesn't it? And it's got a Ron Fuller's, another now regrettably dead colleague of mine, because he also made Kicking Ladies. But it's something that you tend to do if you make mechanical toys, you know. Is that enough? The MP3 player is in the big organ. And the day after the private view of the exhibition, a man sent me 80 tunes, most of them German oompa-ish things. But it's lots of fun. I mean, and it means that Matthew's written for it, haven't you, Matthew?
Yeah.
Yes, Matthew's written a tune, which it starts off with Shepherd's Hay, the Morris dance. And it sort of merges into Tomorrow Belongs to Me from the cabaret. Not everybody gets that, but I don't care.
Kill my friends here. Is there anything else anyone else wants to ask?
Jeff Nicholson, what do you want to say? Oh, God.
I'm interested in the relationship between you and your collectors. You seem rather sort of sniffy about them there. It's not really a question, but how do you feel about them? And another question, and do you make them to order, your machines to order?
Not very willingly, no. No, because commissions are difficult, for instance, because I don't like other people's ideas very much, you know. James Horner, who was, you know, a massive collector, hopelessly addicted collector, crashed his aeroplane and is dead. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Yes, it's not my fault.
No.
But he was a composer of music for films. Wrote Titanic.
Do you know what happened to that
collection? Yes, I saw Sue unearthed something recently, and some James Horner fans were allowed to visit the collection. I meant to email it to you, actually. In fact, I thought I had. No, anyway, and so it's there, and it looks like a jumble sale. You know, I was a bit disappointed because I thought it would be a sort of, you know, monument or, you know, a temple, but it just looks like a bloody jumble sale, or, you know, car boat sale.
Oh, well, there's another question behind me.
It's a bit of a segue. You said you don't like other people's ideas. I was going to ask, because you work with Matt Smith.
Oh, yeah. No, Matt and I...
Are there other people you'd love to, like,
Yeah, no, and
I'd love to work with Sadly on hearing.
I work with Tim Hunkin a bit. I do the fiddly bits. I do the faces and things sometimes that he can't be bothered to do. Well, they don't look like faces, you know. So I do that.
And well, Kazoo, Tim is very much the chainsaw school of all time.
Tim is rough.
Yes, yeah. Very rough.
But he's, you know, he knows how to do rough. You know, some of us can carry rough off. Is Hunky? No, he isn't. He's in Suffolk, isn't he?
There's somebody up there who would like ask a question or make a remark.
Have you made anything really big? Like, you started off, I think, with a skeleton in Covent Garden that was possibly actual size.
Yeah, no, no. Ride of Life. Ride of Life.
Oh, God, the Ride of Life.
Yeah, no. What? It's another... No, I have made big things. What?
Louis Vuitton.
Oh, well, they're sort of big. That was the luxury goods adventure where I made things with Will Jackson, brother, for Louis Vuitton, who I'd never heard of when they came.
What were those?
Well, you know those that luggage that they make luggage.
We all know the luggage.
And they stamp it with their monogram. There's where the rot set in with all this stuff and people having Nike and stuff written all over them. And that was in 18 something or other. And they were having a centenary exhibition. And their brilliant idea was to commission a lot of designers, 8, I think. You were there. You went to the thing, didn't you? To design bags.
Yeah.
I gave them a couple of years to do it. And then thought, we want some of these charming automata things to hang the bags on. It gave us about 6 weeks to do it. Yeah. I think Willie and I still think it was the most awful thing we ever did. Yeah. And we were forced to go to... They had these parties all over the place. Forced to go to Paris... Forced to go to Tokyo, Madrid, Hong Kong, just to make sure they still worked, which I think they nearly did, except people would nick bits off them. But they'd nick a hand, figures, they'd nick a hand because it had a Louis Vuitton bag on it. So, right, I'll have that. And these were the toffs who went to their, customers who went to their parties. It was a very unedifying thing. Yeah, but, you know.
Yeah, so never again.
They'll never ask again. No, that's not going to happen.
Yes, what did you... Lady there in the yellow.
Hello, I'm interested if you use anything in the way of some of the later technology you've got around these days, like 3D printing or laser cutters.
No.
Don't stand for those.
No, hammer and chisel. No, fret saw. No, I can't. I don't like laser... cutting because it leaves a little black mark around it. No, I don't like that. No. Sorry. you don't work for a laser cutter.
Hello. yes.
My mum used to bring me and my brother up to London when we were kids, and we were completely entranced by cabaret. And particularly sort of trying to imagine it as a place now, it just seems completely improbable that it ever was there or in Covent Garden. I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you got involved with that and how that came about.
Well, yeah, because that's a whole chapter,
That
is a whole chapter.
Sue Jackson, who sadly died very recently, but whose daughter is here, Sarah. And it was Sue, because I did it. When did I do that exhibition at Festival Hall?
92.
Thank you. because you know people and you follow things, but you don't actually ever really sit them down and interview them until 30 years later. And I organised, in the loosest sense, organised an exhibition at the Festival Hall of Automata based entirely on what I'd learned from cabaret and from Sue. And also relying very heavily on Gary, who actually made sure the machines kept working day in, day out. Yes, I know, looking
nightmare.
Still looking tired. And but by interviewing Sue, I realised that she had, because she never made a big thing of this, but I mean, she mortgaged her house twice to keep this thing going. I mean, it was the most amazing high wire act financially, but she so believed in it. And she carried everyone forward. And I mean, the fact that Covent Garden lost cabaret, was bad luck for Covent Garden and for us in London. But no, Sue, a very happy memory, deserves enormous praise. Mm. And she somehow got all you lot together, didn't she?
She used to call it animating us. It annoyed the hell out of me.
You did at one stage. You did an automaton of Sue working you with her foot.
Yeah, I'm fret sawing. I think. Yeah. Mm. Very early on, it set in very quickly. That relationship. Yeah. And I've always been, pretty enslaved by her, and now Sarah's taken over. So.
Have you ever worked in any other materials apart from wood?
Well, yes, I work with anything that works. I will stoop to using plastic and metal. I've got a little Myford lathe and I make metal bits. But I don't... What don't I use? I don't mould things. I have done. I tried lots of things. It just depends what the job is, really. So I do, yes. Answer's yes.
Anyone else? Yes.
Hi. I was in the park in Falmouth in the summer, and I saw the lovely things for the children to play with. Are there any other parks around the country that have
Is
that not your stuff in there?
No, one of them is.
It's
just
one of
the goat. The goat is mine.
I thought it was. Yeah. You haven't done
spotted.
Any for any others.
No. I've done one piece of public art. Is on the front of the Exeter Art Centre. It's called the Phoenix Art Centre because I made a hydraulic phoenix to go on the front of it. And that was one of those things that was commissioned for the millennium and then just sort of when it stopped, because hydraulic things need maintenance, it's never been fixed. So last time but one I saw, it was sort of like this. It was a bird with a 12-foot wingspan. And it sort of, when it worked, it lurched out from the front of the building. I'm probably making it sound better than it is. But it's made of copper and hydraulic bits and pieces. And it lurches out. It's got eyes that light up. It's another thing that Will Jackson helped with. Made, sort of, really. I wanted it to sort of looked around. It was, and it was quite a sort of terrifying thing on the top of the building. And it's had this hydraulic power pack inside it, which was its downfall, really, because it was inside the building in the office of the bloke who, at the time, ran the, I think it was the West Country Children's Orchestra. And when it started, every hour this thing would start up, and it made a tremendous screeching noise. So I think they were quite glad when it kind of needed mending, and they didn't call me.
Well, the children in the park seemed to be enjoying it while I was there.
So when did you go?
In July.
In July? Yeah, and it's still working?
Yeah, yeah.
Good, thanks, that's what I'd like to hear.
Yeah. And what about the Eden Project?
That's another chapter.
Oh, sorry.
You have to come back.
Okay.
No, Eden? No, you're not allowed to. You've finished your question. No, Rosemary, no. No, I've done... there are things in the Eden Project as well.
Yes.
They hired me and various other people, local people, to make things. But now they've sort of gone for people from outside. Actually, from China, I think, have made the latest thing. And it's okay. But I was standing next to a man, a Chinese man, and looking at this new exhibit. And I said, what's this all about? And he explained it to me in great detail. And I said, how do you know all this? He said, well, I made it. And and I said to him, I'm the bloke whose stuff they've just chucked out. And he was very respectful. But I don't know what happens to those things at the Eden. I don't know, they must have a sort of shed somewhere that they put stuff.
Another shed.
Yeah.
Another shed.
Yeah.
I think we should probably... Oh, just yeah.
What happens when the thing don't work?
No, she said... I don't want to hear... No, she said... No, I have lots of sleepless nights. I mean, I dread the phone ringing of somebody saying, you know that thing you made in 1984? It doesn't work, you know. I want another one, or I want something better or different. It's just awful. I shouldn't do this, because everything does break. It's the only definite thing about...
Yeah.
That's one of my things that I say.
It is.
The only thing you can be sure of with these machines is that they'll break.
Yes. No, I remember when I came to interview you and you just said, you know, that whole thing about anything going like clockwork, that means it's going to break.
Break, yes. Yeah. True, yeah. Cuckoo clock, good though, wasn't it? British Museum, top of the British Museum, cuckoo clock.
How old was that?
1860 something, I think. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.